Welcome to Millington Baptist Church. The message you are about to hear was delivered at Millington by Dr. Peter Pendell.
Well, they said it could never happen. In fact, in my early years, I believed it could never happen. A black man being president of the United States, you've got to be kidding. That was one of those, you know, those glass ceilings. That thing will never be broken. How could that ever happen? In fact, other things are passing by that I could have never imagined either. That next Monday, a week from Monday, I think it's the 21st, no, someplace around there, is the Martin Luther King Jr. birthday. I'll tell you, that was like science fiction if somebody had ever mentioned that when I was a kid. Couldn't possibly happen. Amazing things are going on. In fact, if you just look back in history a little bit, you might remember that it was just 45 years ago that George Wallace became governor of Alabama, and his commitment and his promise was to maintain segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever. I still remember him standing at the door of the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, refusing entry for people whose skin was different than theirs, and seeming to get away with it at least for a time. I remember Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on the bus. I remember the marches in Selma. I remember from personal experience the whites colored signs over the drinking fountains in Greenville, Mississippi, where I was stationed for a time. Whites colored. I remember Dr. King speaking about a dream. I remember feeling like it was all falling apart when he died, was assassinated. When I look back on those days, I feel like it must have been another century. I guess it was in some sense, but I feel like it was maybe the 19th century that I'm talking about. No, maybe it was the 17th century that those things happened in. Maybe my memory's poor, and it was another country. It wasn't even our country. Did we really say those things? Did we have those signs? Did I walk by those signs and think almost nothing of them, even though my best friend was a black man? And couldn't ride in the part of the bus that I rode in. We went from the base into town. For some of you, I'm speaking ancient history, and you can't remember those days because you weren't alive during those days, but those were the days. Yeah, I remember those days. They were very much a part of my life. That a kid couldn't go to school or live in a certain neighborhood or get a job because his skin was a different color than that of the majority. Did we really limit people like that? Many of us, and I'm one of them, lives with the regret that I didn't have the discernment nor the courage, I guess, or a combination of the two, to stand up and say, hey, I just can't live with this. You can't treat people like that. And these are people, and so you can't treat people like that. But for, I guess, a million reasons, what seems to be so clear now, I look back on it and I say, boy, it just didn't seem to be so black and white, if you will, back then. So I didn't do anything about it. I had other convictions and didn't see the things were so obvious. But now I wish I had faced the water cannon. I wish I had been there with the dogs that were vicious. And I wish I could look back and say, yeah, I stood up for what was right then. But I didn't, and lots of people didn't. So whether I voted for Barack Obama or not, and I won't tell you if I did, whether I did or not, I was thrilled to see that we could finally get over that color line that seemed so impossible to broach when he was elected and declared to be the president-elect. And whether I voted for him or not, I tell you what, I commit myself to pray for that man, and I commit myself to pray for the people he surrounds him with, and maybe I'll pray more for them than I did for the current occupant of the White House, because he and I see things the same in so many cases. Because there are going to be lots of things that I won't see things the same with Barack Obama, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to pray for him. Ask God to make him a roaring success so that he can see the best things to do and lead us in the right direction. So where are we? Is the bigotry all gone? Is the prejudice gone? Nah. Not as long as we're alive. Not as long as human beings occupy the face of the earth. Are there no longer any things to strive for, to work for, to fight for, to maybe even march for? No, there's things that need to be done yet. But I am personally thrilled that those things that were so much a part of my earlier years seem to be past in some sense, and we seem to be at a different place as a nation. In fact, this morning, I want to go beyond civil rights. I have a plan every January, the first Sunday of January. I want to talk about, as we come around the communion table, how Jesus will lead us into the coming year. And then the second year, because it's so close to the Martin Luther King birthday, I want to talk about things like bigotry and prejudice that so easily finds a home in each one of us, and somehow talk from the scriptures about how we need to go in a different direction with that. And then the third Sunday normally is what I see as the greatest abuse of civil rights of all in our day, and that is abortion and the message of life. And so next Sunday we'll get to that, so I won't get into that at all today, but I really think that's the ultimate and what we need to be thinking about as a baseline, as kind of a foundation for that and for bigotry and for all others of our relationships where they don't work right, is the idea of honoring one another, because I think that's the foundation stone for all the rest of it. If we will simply learn to honor one another, then we'll deal with a lot of this stuff long before the natural progression of history seems to take us there. Because honoring one another, to me, is really what civil rights is all about. It's what reaching out with respect to other people with whom I don't agree. In fact, I'd like to go way beyond the color line today. I'd like to go beyond the gender line. I'd like to go beyond the political party line. I won't agree with everything in any group that I talk about today. I'd like to go beyond the sexual preference line in the way that we treat people, in the whole idea of honoring one another. I had a rude awakening the other day. We moved out of our Christian bubble for about a minute and a half with a film that came in from Netflix. I had chosen it. It looked like it was a funny film. It was a comedy. And if you've seen it, you'll recognize it. I won't give you the name because I don't want anybody to go out and get it. Or to me, seem to be I'm recommending it because I'm really not. Because about a minute and a half, Ilona and I said, this is garbage. We sent it back. But if you've seen it, you'll recognize it was two young guys, probably, I don't know, 15 and 17. I'm not sure how old they were. But when the part I remember is them going into a store and buying things and talking about the women in their life. It was crud. It was treating young women that they had some kind of a relationship with as objects in the crudest sense that you can imagine. So I'm not telling you the name. I don't want you to go get it. But if you've seen it, let me tell you, it has no place for you or for me. It doesn't matter how old you are. The way I treat a woman says a whole lot about my relationship with Jesus Christ. It really does. But what that did was it kind of yanked me and said, you're in a bubble, Peter. I'm afraid this is where a large part of our culture lives in terms of its attitude, in particular towards women. I'm convinced that we have to honor one another. Now, where do we get that idea? Where does the idea come to us that the gas chambers of the 40s were from the pit of hell? Where do I get the idea that for a man to hit a woman is so far from what God has in mind for us in the way we treat each other? Where do I get the idea that looking at a woman on a screen, partially clothed in some enticing manner, that's against the will of God for me or for anybody? Where do I get that idea? Well, I get that idea from God. And I get that idea because God is our creator, and God made us to be better than that. And he made all men and women to be better than that. I get that idea from the Bible. In fact, when I go to the Bible, I get the idea that we are all created by God. And if you will, let me play with an idea here. We are all cut from the same bolt of cloth. Yeah, that's where I get that idea. Honoring one another. It's as if the tailor who made us took a bolt of cloth, and you've seen the cloth perhaps in the stores, and took a bolt of cloth and he laid it out and he made every man, he cut out every man and every woman and every boy and every girl, and he made them from that same bolt of cloth, and then he stamped them with his name as the one who had made them. And when I look at men and women with that kind of a picture, that's a world of difference in terms of how I design my life to treat men and women, whether it's my own wife or my kids or it's It's you or it's somebody I don't agree with in terms of some area of life. Let me take you back to Genesis. It's on the screen. You can welcome to turn there if you'd like to. But chapter 1, verse 26 and verse 27, we're moving along in the creation account. You know that in Genesis chapter 1 starts out in the very beginning, and God creates different categories of life. And now he's gotten to chapter 1, verse 26, and God says, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." And then it says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And friends and neighbors, that's the difference. Not just men, but men and women. It's an inclusive sense of he created him. And it gets very clarified, male and female, he created them. So him is divided into male and female. But the important thing about that is in the image of God. Now, this is the first generation of people that was created in the image of God. And then God doesn't recreate every person along the way. He relies on procreation to have that take place. But what he does do is he passes along that unique characteristic of men and women down from generation to generation and father to and mother to child. And then they grow up and they have children, father and mother to child. And every man, every woman, every boy, or every girl is different from everything else in all of creation because they have this thing called the image and likeness of God. Every man, every woman. Not the plants, not the trees, not the rocks, not the mountains, not the dog. I know you have a wonderful dog and he's almost human. I know that. I don't mean to insult you with your dog. But the dogs aren't like us. They're more protected in some parts of the world than babies are. That's a tragedy of immense proportions, but they're not like us because dogs don't have the image of God. They are not made in the likeness of God. Now, what's that mean? I say that phrase as if we all agree on what that means, and theologians down through the years have tried to figure out what the image of God is like. What is that? And they've come up with all kinds of formulas, but I've really settled my own thinking on two of them, two pieces that will make up the image and likeness of God. One is that we are self-reflective. I can say, I am, I feel, I want, and I can say that in a rational sense. I have a mind to be able to think of those things and to be able to reflect upon myself and measure myself and evaluate myself and know that I exist and know that I can do certain things. And well, obviously, rocks don't have that, but neither do dogs, and neither do cats, and neither do lions, and neither do mountain goats, and neither do trees or other parts of the creation. That's where I'm different. With a dog, it's instinct that a dog runs from danger. But with me, as my mind develops at least, then I recognize danger and I plan a strategy to get away from danger. That's different than a dog or different than anything else. In fact, I look in a mirror and I can recognize myself. I say, woe is me when I look in the mirror, but I can recognize myself. I say, that's Peter. And he has a wife named Amy, or Ilona. Sheesh. Ilona. Yeah, Amy's first name is Ilona. I don't know if that makes that better or not. But anyway, Ilona, and I got to get this right. I got a daughter named Amy and a son named Jonathan and a son named Drew and a grand. Yeah. But see, I can do that. My dog, as wonderful as he might be, can't do that. And that sets us apart and it makes us different. The other part of what's different about me and about you is that we can relate to God. I can relate to myself, and I can relate to others like myself and unlike myself, but I can also relate to God. That makes me a spiritual being, and again, other parts of creation, as wonderful as they may be and as beautiful as they may be, they are not the same. They are not like me. And they're not like you, because we're human beings, and we're all cut, in that sense, from the same cloth. We're not all the same. Not everything's the same about us. I wouldn't want to give that indication because we're all different. All we have to do is look around and look at personalities and gifts and abilities. We're not the same, but we are the same as distinct from the rest of creation. You say, wait a minute. What about some of these other bad examples? What about Stalin and Hussein? And what about Peter Pendel when he's rude and selfish? Well, the cloth is stained and it's torn. And depending on the person and perhaps what they learned as they grew up and perhaps the difficulties of life, and I don't know what else influences this, but some is much more stained and some is much more torn than others. Stalin's was almost destroyed, but it was still there. That's what we have to remember. And the person who drives you crazy in the office and uses all the foul language, they're still made in the image and likeness of God. And the person who thinks differently than you do, still made in the image and likeness of God. They are still bearers of the image and likeness of God. But you know as well as I do, if you go back to Genesis, likewise, chapter 3 of Genesis, Eve made a decision, and then Adam decided he was going to side with Eve and not with God. Eve was deceived, Paul tells us, and she ate from the fruit, not an apple, but from the fruit. And when Adam had a chance to say something in the beginning, he didn't say anything. And then when he is challenged to be with her or with God, then he takes her side, and he separates himself likewise from God. And that's where the fabric gets soiled, and that's where it gets torn. It's right in those first decisions of that man and that woman. And then that is passed on as they go on populate the world. I know I'm giving an overview, but remember what Paul says in Romans chapter 5. He describes what's happened, that sin entered the world through one man, not through the woman, through the man. He says the woman was deceived, but the man did it knowingly. It was an open act of rebellion against God. So through one man and death through sin, and in this way death came to all men because all sinned. So the principle of sin goes down. The nature of sin goes down from generation to generation, and we live that out and confirm it's really there, isn't it? Yeah. And everybody who's been hurt by somebody else can say, I see it in him and I see it in her. And if you have a child who moves from infancy into 2 and 3 years old, then you see the sin nature there too. It just doesn't show itself in the beginning, but it does as time goes on. The beautiful thing is, though, that we can be repaired, and we can be cleansed, and we can be set new, and the fabric doesn't have to stay so soiled, and doesn't have to stay so torn as it is from the way that we entered into the world. Humpty Dumpty can be put back together again. That's the good news of the gospel. In fact, there's a passage in Ephesians 2, verse 10, and it comes from the New Living Translation that I just love the way that it's put. It says, You are God's masterpiece. You are, and I am. We are God's masterpiece. He has created us anew in Christ Jesus so that we can do the good things he planned for us long ago. Isn't that a beautiful picture? That men and women whose fabric has been torn and dirtied and sullied through faith in Jesus Christ can be cleansed, and the fabric can be sewn together again so that it can be the object of beauty that God intended it to be. But even when that does not yet happen, even when you're talking about men and women who have refused to say yes to Jesus and have the soil removed and the fabric repaired, those men and women still carry the image of God, and that's what I sometimes forget. They still carry the image of God. They're still made in the image of God. And somehow, in my dealings with them, I still have to treat them with honor. See, the basis for honoring people is not a law that says I have to do this or that, though laws are necessary, and I don't mean to say that they're not. If you can't get people to be persuaded out of the goodness of their hearts to allow people to have a decent job, then you better make a law for it. And that's just the way it is. But that's not what makes me honor other people, and that's not the basis of it that changes cultures and society. What changes cultures and societies is the basis for honoring people is they're made in the image of God. And this is one of those places where we have every reason to go to our friends who believe in evolution, and maybe you believe in evolution, but let me challenge that. If you believe in evolution, especially if it's not theistic evolution, you don't have any reason to honor other people. It's only because men and women are made in the image of God that you have reason to honor them. I'm honoring an image bearer when I take care of other people who don't agree with me, or who are down and out, and I get myself all dirty taking care of them. That's an image bearer. That's why I take care of him or her. Not because the law says I have to, but because they're an image bearer. And in fact, you know the name Bernie Madoff. You've heard it enough, haven't you? Well, if evolution is true, he was just doing what he had to do to stay on top. And there's no reason to put him in jail. He just kind of went too far. But if creation is true, if you're made in the image and likeness of God, then I can't take advantage of you with those funds, and I can't lie about the books, and I can't cook the books, and And I've got to treat people fairly who work for me. And I've got to treat them with honor, even if I have to lay them off. And it just makes all the difference in the world if we're made in the image and likeness of God. This is not small. This is mammoth. And evolution has done a terrible job in taking us away from that. In fact, you can go to extremes, and I want to get us to a particular passage in a minute, but you can go to extremes when you talk about the abuse of one person for another. And surely the time in Germany in Second World War is one of those times of great abuse. It's not the only one. Stalin was just as bad, and in Russia probably, but somehow the Holocaust is the one that stands out, and it's always of interest to me to try to understand how would I have gotten sucked into that if I had been there? And I'm not saying I wouldn't have. So please don't think that I'm saying I'm better than anybody who was there at the time. But I was reading a book, found it in a used bookshop, called Defying Hitler by Sebastian Hafner. And Hafner grew up during World War I, and so he saw the thing from the beginning. He saw what happened in World War I and the Treaty of Versailles and things like that. And he saw how people came to the forefront and how this army corporal ended up in the charge and control of the country. And he was in training for the legal system in Germany. So he was right there when things started to go bad and certain categories of people were mistreated and taken advantage of. And finally, in 1939, he left and got out of there for England and stayed in England for the rest of the war and for some years after that. But he wrote this book, Defying Hitler. And his whole attempt was to give a memoir in which he saw it coming. And sometimes he did something, sometimes he didn't do things. But what he saw coming was, in retrospect, so subtle and so piecemeal that when they finally got to the laws that said, okay, Jews have to wear these armbands, it was the next natural step. It wasn't a major step. It was the next natural step. And it all came from this idea of classifying people as something that's not worthy of care by others who were there, whether it was Jews or gay people or mentally challenged people or handicapped people or whoever it was. It was putting them into a category. You see, as soon as I take them out of the category, the one category that matters, made in the image and likeness of God, I can do anything with them. And that's what happened. And Hafner bears testimony to that fact. I've got the book. You can borrow it if you want to. Well, we're not there. Thank God we're not there. Are we subject to that? Yeah, I suspect we are subject to that, but we're not there. So what I really want to do today is talk about something less than that, because that won't help us. I'd like to talk about our lesser ways of dissing people. You know what dissing means? Kind of a new word. Dismissing. If you just think of dissing as dismissing, that's really what it is. It's dissing means that you say or you act in such a way to show disrespect to another person by insulting them or by criticizing them, and the insult may be very obvious or it may not be so obvious. But as I went back to the scriptures again and saw the teaching of Paul in this case in Ephesians chapter 4, I realized that he's talking about dissing people. We used to diss people. We can't diss people anymore. And there's an insert in your bulletin, and I intentionally took the message paraphrase today because I really wanted us to read it with a different sound. And I took that and put it in the bulletin and the insert on the other side of the message outline. And I did that because I'd love to see us take out our pens and just kind of underline those words that Paul must have been thinking about, how we diss people before we come to faith in Jesus Christ, and how inappropriate that is once we've come to faith in Christ. So if you want to take that out, you're welcome to it. And I'll be underlining mine as we go along and just underline those areas that are especially pertinent for us in the 21st century in terms of the way we need to treat each other as made in the image of God and beyond each other, but out into that place, into the political realm and the work realm and homes, and you get the idea. It's Ephesians chapter 4, and it's starting with verse 17. It's kind of interesting. The heading on this in the message paraphrase is "The Old Way Has to Go." Paul writes, "And so I insist, and God backs me up on this, that there be no going along with the crowd, the empty-headed, mindless crowd, They've refused for so long to deal with God that they've lost touch not only with God but with reality itself. They can't think straight anymore. Feeling no pain, they let themselves go in sexual obsession, addicted to every sort of perversion. You can stop right there, and if I were you, I'd underline sexual obsession, every sort of perversion. It comes when I begin to think of women or men as less than in the image of God. If I look at that man or that woman and I say, there's the image of God born by that man or that woman, I cannot go there in terms of these things. Verse 20, but that's no life for you. You learned Christ. My assumption is that you have paid careful attention to him, been well instructed in the truth, precisely as we have it in Jesus. Since then, we do not have the excuse of ignorance. Everything, and I do mean everything, I like that, connected with that old way of life has to go. It's rotten through and through. Get rid of it, and then take on an entirely new way of life, a God-fashioned life, a life renewed from the inside, and working itself into your conduct as God accurately reproduces his character in you. What this adds up to, then, is this: no more lies, no more pretense. And I would, boy, I'd underline that, because I can't minimize people and be able to tell them anything but the truth. Doesn't mean I have to say everything I know, but I can't deceive. I can't mislead. Not if I'm treating you as bearers of the image, in the same way I want you to treat me. Tell your neighbor the truth. In Christ's body, we're all connected to each other, after all. When you lie to others, you end up lying to yourself. Go ahead and be, this is neat, isn't it? Go ahead and be angry. That makes me feel better, doesn't it? Yeah, you do well to be angry, but don't use your anger as fuel for revenge. Don't stay angry. Don't go to bed angry. There are a lot of things out there that ought to make us angry. And you know, one of the things I say to myself is, how come you're not angry very often anymore, Peter? Because there's a lot of stuff out there that's taking advantage of people. I ought to be angry at the stuff that's allowed to be on the airwaves. I ought to be angry at the stuff that allows people to traffic in human beings, children and women in particular around the world, and it's a major, major industry, believe me. I ought to be angry that a child can be taken from the womb minutes before it would otherwise be born and be put to death. Not at the people be angry, but at whatever allows that to happen. I ought to be angry. But I can't allow that anger to stick with me and cause me to seek revenge from the people who are involved. That's the issue. So I've got to find constructive ways to deal with it. Is this literally before I go to bed at night? Probably not. But it's that immediate, I can't let this thing build. I can't let it go like that. I've got to find ways to deal with that in a constructive manner so that I'm a part of what helps to make things right instead of what makes them poor. Well, I'll go on a little bit more. Sorry, verse 27. Don't give the devil that kind of foothold in your life. Did you used to make ends meet by stealing? Well, no more. Get an honest job so that you can help others who can't work. That's not as easy to say as it used to be, perhaps, to get a job. But stealing's not the answer. Watch the way you talk. Let nothing foul or dirty come out of your mouth. Say only what helps, each word a gift. You know, the people I really struggle for are high school kids and college kids. Because if you're in those schools, you're surrounded all the time. If you don't want to live in the glass bubble of just me and my Christian friends, and you want to get together with other people who are not Christians, then you've got to find ways to deal with that. And I don't have the answer all the time about how to deal with that, kids. But I'm telling you, you can't let that stuff corrupt you on the inside. That's like a stain that'll affect you. It'll come out. It just has a way of coming out once it gets into my gut. I feel for you. Don't grieve God. Don't break his heart. His Holy Spirit moving and breathing in you is the most intimate part of your life, making you fit for himself. Don't take such a gift for granted. Make a clean break with all the cutting, backbiting, profane talk. I'd underline that too. Cutting, backbiting, profane talk. That's dissing people. That's treating them as less than the image bearers that they are. Skip down to verse 3 of chapter 5. Don't allow love to turn into lust. setting off a downhill slide into sexual promiscuity, filthy practices, or bullying, greed. It's really kind of interesting to me, the ideas he mixes here. You know, turn love into lust, and I think about pornography naturally and living it out with other people, and setting off a downhill slide into sexual promiscuity. It kind of fits in the same category, and filthy practices, and my mind still does, but bullying, greed. I don't know why he put those three together, but they're all means of diminishing people and treating them as if they weren't the image bearers of the living God, no matter how much I disagree with them, no matter how much they walk on the other side. Though some tongues, verse 4, just love the taste of gossip. Underline that. Christians have better uses for language than that. And then very simply, don't talk dirty or silly. Kind of talk doesn't fit our style. Thanksgiving is our dialect. That's why I like to read the message from time to time. Thanksgiving is our dialect. Not dirty talk, not silly talk. It's the way we treat people. And God's word has so much to say about the way we treat people. Those are kind of obvious. I had a couple of other things that I couldn't help but think of when I was preparing the message. I'm really going to step on your toes, so you're really going to have to forgive me and be generous with me and don't leave. And I understand when I talk about some things that I call the I wonder ways of dissing people. I wonder if we're dissing people in some of these ways. You know, they may just be things that bug me alone. And I also recognize that they may be generational in nature. So if this doesn't bother your generation, then that's fine. Or they may have the ring of truth. Let me take it from when we were raising our kids until something more recently today. And that is giving each other our full attention when the full attention should be expected. Now, when I'm at the door and I can't give you full attention, it's because there's all kinds of other people. But I'll tell you what, if you're sitting in my office and you're telling me the issues that you're struggling with, I better be fully attending you. And if I'm not, then maybe something else is so important on my mind that I can't get away from it. But if it isn't, then I'm dissing you. And I'm treating you as less than the image bearer that you really are. Well, take that into the home. Parents, doesn't it drive you crazy when you talk to your kids and they're watching TV? Yeah, sure it does. Why? Because they're not giving you your full attention. Doesn't it drive you nuts when you try to talk to somebody and they're reading a magazine? Yeah. Does it drive you nuts when you're talking to somebody? Maybe that's generational. Or maybe even worse. Yeah. I wonder if that's dissing people. It's not like pornography. I know that. And it's not that it is never appropriate. I know that. And I come from, you know, I'm 103 years old, so you'll have to forgive me for that. But somewhere in there, there's connection that's supposed to take place between people. And I'll be really honest with you. I use email and I use texting and I do all that stuff. But there's something going on today that though we think we're making connection with a lot of people, I deeply suspect that it's about that deep. And yeah, I'm on Facebook, yeah. But man, some of the electronic means of making connections, it doesn't drive us deeper than the very surface level. And it won't last, and they won't be there when the real hurts of life come. It's only as I have relationships that are built over time, eyeball to eyeball, sharing life with each other, that relationships are built that are going to stand the test of time when things get hard. So don't delude yourself. If you have 300 people on your Facebook friends, that doesn't mean you have 300 friends. Not in the quality that you need. Don't diss people that way. I wonder, here's another one. I'm going to close my eyes while I talk about it so I can't see anybody leave, okay? I wonder if we allow dissing input so much that it leads us to diss others. Let me take somebody from both extremes. Keith Olbermann. Rush Limbaugh. I'm not saying you can't listen to those things and keep a balance, but I know that the balance is lost very easily if you listen to too much. Because what those guys do, and they do it for entertainment, and I'm sure they've got a worthy goal besides that, but it's entertainment. It really is. Everybody acknowledges that. What they do is they take large groups of people and they put them in categories. And see, as soon as I put somebody in category, well, then I can take the worst of that category and treat everybody in the category like that. Well, they are that, aren't they? Well, they may be, but they may not be like that guy over there. So what I've done is I've reduced people. I've minimized people. And you know what's gotten lost in the process? Image bearers. That those folks are image bearers. And if they're image bearers, then I don't treat them like I treat my dog. And I don't treat them like I treat the cat. And I don't treat them like anything but human beings. And if I can get a hold of the image bearer thing, it's going to make a world of difference in terms of my relationships with people, whether they're black or white or green or purple, young or old, whoever they are. Because my words will be contained by my respect for them out of being image bearers. Let me give you a physical example, and then I'll quit because we've got to get going. But some time ago, I realized how big I am. And I think I realized it because I knocked a woman over in the foyer. Or almost. I probably didn't knock anybody over, but I could see women retreating from me. Now, I didn't do it this badly, but it was almost like this, you know, I'm just kind of big and I walk around in the foyer. And what would you do if you were this high and you were a woman? You'd get out of the way. And I realized, I gotta keep my hands down. I can't go like that in point, or like that in point, and I can't go like this because I'm going to knock about five people out in the process. I can do that with my words, though. I can use my words without any sense of caution for the way that they'll beat other people up and knock them over and discourage them. Somebody had left Millington because in their spirits they were so hurt by things people said. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if they had a right to be. You know, I don't know. If you're going to survive in a church for very long, and I've been here for a while, you got to learn to let those things go. You can't hang on to those and make a major case because you're going to get hurt. You're in the same building all the time. You're in the same ministry, have different opinions. Yeah, I'm going to get hurt. Of course I'm going to. So I can't become tough-skinned and hard-skinned, but somehow I have to be able to let those things go under the blood of Jesus and realize that I do the same kinds of things to people and just get along, you know, and let those things go and forgive. But I heard about a couple that left because they were hurt by words. And to the extent that it's true, breaks my heart. Because if there's any place where the words ought to be encouraging for building up, it's in the church. Because we're the ones who know about the image in other people. And when we fail, then we got to recognize it and go back to the people and say, hey, I forgot the image in you. I forgot, sorry. I hate what you think. I don't like what you stand for, but I forgot the image. I don't want to do that anymore. It's in the church that people have a right, in a sense, to expect us to be different. Not perfect, but different. There's one last statement in this passage in Ephesians 5 that really grabbed hold of my, or Ephesians 4, it's chapter 4, verse 31. And I really think this kind of sums it up. Be gentle with one another. Any gentleness that is a part of my nature comes from my mom. And she taught me to be gentle with people. And in fact, she so taught me that I became adverse to conflict. You know what I mean? I'd run from it because I wanted to be gentle. And I've had to learn over the years, and I'm still in the learning process, I've had to learn over the years that I can speak the truth and still be gentle. I don't have to blow people away to speak the truth. But I can speak the truth in such a manner that I can get the truth across, but also the understanding that I care about you and I honor the image of God that lives within you. And I want to be there for you, but still speak the truth. You know what I mean? Be gentle with each other. That's what God's looking for. And when I'm not, you know what you have to do. You go back and say, wasn't gentle? Apologize to God, I apologize to you. I want to learn how to be gentle. Some of you have taught me how to be gentle because you've talked to me about places where I'm deficient. But you've done it in such a manner that I came away from that feeling like he really cares about me. That's all I need to know. Maybe you have people to talk to after the message today. I don't know. Maybe this is old news and you don't need very much of this. But it seems to me if we can honor one another inside the church and outside the church, we'll go a long ways towards the generation of peace and truth that we sang about in the reconciliation song. Let's pray together, please.